Hey everyone, just a quick heads up before we dive into this beautiful conversation. So real talk, during our live recording, my mic went off and I had to restart my computer. I couldn't even hear the guests and they couldn't hear me. So technology, right? But here's the best part. While I was offline, our incredible guests didn't miss a bit. They stepped up, held it down and kept the conversation flowing with so much grace and wisdom. And honestly, that's the kind of energy I live for, community, resilience, and people showing up for one another. So if you hear a brief silence or transition, and all of a sudden, what happened to the host? Hope this clears itself. That's what happened. But don't worry, the magic is all still there. Now let's get into the episode and enjoy the show. Okay. All right. Can you hear me? We good? Okay. Welcome back, everyone, to the Monstable Podcast. This is a special live episode where we are just going to talk about parenting across board, especially when it comes to interfacing with the educational system. And I'm joined by a wonderful set of panelists whom I'm going to be introducing in a bit. But if you're just joining us for the first time, welcome aboard. And for those that will watch the replay, thank you so much. This is the Monstable Podcast once again, where we explore the cultural and lived experiences of Blacks, Asians, and those who love them. And I'm your host, Monstable. And today's show is probably one of the most personal ones I've done. And I know I say that a lot when I, you know, tell you guys a lot about my life. But if someone had told me that I'll be sharing this part of my story after all we've been through, I probably would have laughed or cried or maybe both. But here we are. Because I've learned something powerful. When we set our stories free, we just don't lighten our load. We make space for others to do the same. And I hope that's one thing you take out of today's conversation. Now, today's conversation was born out of a very tough season with my daughter's school, one that left me asking a lot of hard questions, like navigating systems that I thought I was familiar with because I work in a school. And sometimes we felt unseen. But in that journey, I've discovered just how many parents are quietly walking the same road. And I think it's very, very important that even though school season is coming soon, where we're getting ready with our backpacks and lunchboxes, many parents, especially in immigrant and culturally diverse families, are carrying much heavier burdens, misunderstood children, confusing school policies. Perhaps your child is the only one who looks like them in their schools. Or there's some culturally mismatched expectations and emotional fatigue. But this show is created in such a way that we can build support for those kind of topics, right? And before we get started, I just want to be clear from the outset. This is not about bashing teachers or about bashing anyone. Far from it. We value our educators. I'm an educator. You know, bashing teachers, we're bashing myself, you know. So we're not going to do that on this podcast. In fact, we try to include a teacher into this panel, but schedules didn't align. So we plan to have her on a separate episode where we can just take some of the topics we couldn't explore today and get her perspective on it. So don't worry, I got you guys on that. Okay, so these stories are not much about blame, okay? They're about the truth. We're sharing them with care and courage to invite deeper understanding and healing. And this is a conversation I feel that many parents need, but we rarely have. This is going to be a space for us to be honest, to feel seen, to support one another. So we'll be talking about how do we advocate for our kids. We have wonderful panelists joining us. As a matter of fact, five of them, moms, dad, and a developmental behavioral pediatrician. I dare to say that word three times without blabbing. And these panelists have been specifically curated to really give us a robust support on this topic we'll be exploring today. And they're wonderfully real people. I have interacted with them on one-on-one basis, and they're part of my villagers, like I like to call them. So these are people I trust, people who care, people who have walked the hard road and still show up. So whether you're a parent, an educator, or just someone who believes in the power of community, you belong here. Now, let's meet our panelists. And in no order of importance, by the way, because remember I said all of them are special. All right. First is Mrs. Millicent Ololade. She's a nurse practitioner by training and proud mom of four amazing kids. She traded in her stethoscope for the beautiful chaos of full-time motherhood. She's also a content creator, avid reader, and documentary binger. She brings honesty, insight, and hard-earned wisdom about raising kids who don't always fit the mold and also advocating with both grit and grace. And I highly recommend you follow her Instagram. She's so crazy on there and she does a lot of wonderful skits. And next one is Mr. Folabi Okubanjo. He's a catalyst and crusader by design. He brings over 14 years of experience across finance, education, tech, and the nonprofit sector. He's passionate about building systems that transforms lives and that includes his role as a father. He'll be speaking from the often overlooked perspective of dads who are deeply involved, emotionally invested, and learning how to lead their families through tough school seasons. Next is my least favorite cousin, wink wink, joining us from Canada. She's actually my favorite, but don't tell her that. She's a devoted mom of two, a nursing student, and a woman of deep faith. Parenting while pursuing higher education is no small task, and she's been doing both in a system that often operates differently from the U.S. school landscape. She brings insight into how cultural values, advocacy, and perseverance intersect north of the border. And Mrs. Farah Stout, aka Gigi, this is RS Gigi. If you follow my WhatsApp stories, you know her very well. She's a devoted Christ follower. She's a wife, mom, proud mom of six, and Gigi to her grandkids and beyond. She serves as a worship pastor and leads the creative video production and worship team at North Church. She's a singer, songwriter, and spiritual encourager. Farah is passionate about drawing out the God potential in others and has decades of parenting wisdom, advocacy, and growth to share with us tonight. I've also had to literally drag out one of my school meetings to be, you know, another voice of reason to help us navigate so we can share a little bit about what that looks like. And last but definitely not the least is Dr. Demvihin Iyembe. She is a developmental behavioral pediatrician with specialized training in complex developmental and behavioral disabilities. So everything from autism and ADHD to academic underachievement and neurobehavioral disorders. Her passion is school success, and she's here to help us understand how the special education process works and how parents and professionals can partner for real change. Welcome to our panelists, and thanks for joining us today. Can you all still hear? Okay, good. Okay. All right, great. So to get us started, there's something, there's a saying that it takes a village to raise a child. But what you don't really see, sometimes you have to build yourself that village, one conversation at a time, right? So I guess my first question would be for you, Emily. Can you take us back to the first time you realized that when it comes to parenting, especially interfacing with the U.S. educational system, you had to build your own village? And what challenges did you experience that you weren't fully, you know, prepared for?
So we really started noticing. So I went to school in U.S. public system, and then my husband's from Nigeria, so he went to boarding school in Lagos. So we definitely have two different upbringings as far as, I mean, just everything, but specifically we're talking about education. So there was a difference growing up in the U.S. So, you know, most people that I knew went to private or public school. And then I had some friends that went to private school. So you start looking at affordability. My mom wasn't in a position to afford private school. And so luckily the district we lived in at the time was Edmond. So the schools were really great, up and coming, diversity was increasing and whatnot. So once we had children, we had to decide, do we want to do public school or private school and why? And, you know, what's best for our girls? So all of our kids are about a year and a half apart. So our first child, our first two children were born during the pandemic. So, you know, school wasn't an option. And then also any type of daycare or socializing at her age was also very limited. So we already thought she could possibly be on the spectrum slightly because of things that we were noticing. And so we would try to make an effort to sort of get her out. And then we started to think about school because schools were now opening to the children. And so this would be her first year going to pre-K. And so with private school, they offered like a three-year-old pre-K, whereas the public schools offered more of a four to five-year-old pre-K. And so we selected private school. It is quite a drive for us, but we knew that if she did have special needs in the future, that they would have the resources for our child. And so when we went to interview with the school, they said, you know, if we notice anything, if she needs any form of therapy, we bring the therapy to the child. So that way they're not missing any school, you're not having to take off work and whatnot. And so from then on, we enrolled our second child into the same school, and we've just had a positive experience. I would say that while there is a lack of diversity in African-American or African culture there, it's diverse with the Asian community, the Indian community, and also the school does a very good job highlighting all of those special months, like Hispanic Heritage Month, Black History Month. We learn a lot about Indian cultures. They have festivals, they have parades. They'll have families bring food that from home that's from the culture specifically. So they do a great job educating families about diversity within the school. I also will say another thing that I was not prepared for was all of the extracurricular activities that the school offers. So like once a week, there's like, you know, a play day for the age group. Then there's, you know, sometimes we're at two or three birthday parties on one day. So maybe four birthday parties for the weekend. Then they want the moms to get to know each other. So the homeroom mom has to schedule get togethers for dad's parents' night, mom's night, dad's night. Plus the school offers a lot of things or opportunities to come in and meet with the staff, the headmaster, and other parents. So we almost have to kind of balance what we can go to because my husband is a physician and his hours are long. I'm the flexible one because I'm at home, but I also have three other children that even though they're within a year's gap, they're still developmentally at different ages. So I have to pick and choose, you know, which activities I can go to. And then sometimes my husband will take them while I keep the younger ones. So it's just the balance. But I do feel like private school for us was better for our oldest child because of her. Is that me echoing? Let me see if I can turn it down. So with the private school, the classroom sizes are smaller, which we were concerned about her going into a large classroom and possibly being autistic or something like that. And so, you know, the teacher said, well, we've worked with autistic children. We have everything you need. So it just really worked out for us where I have friends that their children go to public school, which is great. But they say the classrooms are overcrowded. You know, there's been some incidents on the bus rides where they're putting, like, I know when I grew up, there'd be one or two kids on the bus per seat. There's like three or four. And so, you know, so we just kind of prayed about it and we made the decision like, you know, and I also say when you make a decision as a parent, it does seem like life or death, but it's really not. Like if private school didn't work out for us or that school didn't work out for us, we could always go somewhere else. So I say that to say sometimes you just have to do what's best for you and your child and your family. And then things will evolve and change along the way. And I'm just one of those people, I'm very type A and I always have a plan and a rule. But I've learned as a mother that it's just not always on the straight and narrow. And God's plan will always make you laugh. Whenever you try to plan, God will have like another option that you completely didn't think was available.
I don't know if you can hear me, but while you're fixing that, Millie, I just wanted to say, like, I echo what you said there. Like, every family has to do what fits your family. There can be so much pressure to fit into a mold and be like everybody else, but like, you have to do what's right and advocate for your family, your schedules, for the different needs of your kids. And I love that.
Yes, thank you so much. It's definitely been a learning lesson because, you know, we just give ourselves lots of grace in this household because you feel like you're missing out or I know you're as a mom of six. It feels like, you know, when we talk about growing our family and my husband says, well, are we being fair to the ones that we have? Like our time is so limited. We're both very busy. And is it right to bring another child and then take time or an activity or an event away from another one? Or just even, you know, I do tutoring at home with the kids like during the summer. And so he's like, can you imagine like you're trying to tutor two kids, you have two babies running around. I mean, it will always be like that. And so you're right. It just, sometimes you just have the guilt of, wow, like, do I have too many kids and are they all getting enough attention and some need more attention than others? So I know you understand that too.
Yeah. And I think that it's important to, this is something that we practice in regard to activities is like having them choose like one main activity in a season if they wanted to try different things at different times. But we can be guilty in our Western culture of overload. Yes. And it overloads everyone.
Yes, it does.
And sometimes that pressure of wanting to keep up, or what you said, like, I don't want my kids to feel like they're missing out on something, but sometimes even helping shape the framework of we're living counterculture. Like, and I love what, like, you have to pray, you know, because we are a faith family as well. And so, like, what is the sacred rhythm for our family and even for that particular kid? Because in a household with many different personalities, you know, or learning styles, like, yes, being okay living outside of the norm.
Yes.
What people say or culture might say is the norm.
Yes. Yes. And when you have, you know, at least three or more children, you're already kind of outside of the norm. And so, but people have just been very supportive and loving, you know, with our family, and completely understandable. And anytime I do get an opportunity to meet with a group of moms or the teachers, I give the disclaimer, like, we really want to try to go to everything, and I would love to bond with you guys and get to know you guys, but I have four kids. And so, you know, we come when we can, and, you know, so it's not always going to be perfect. And so that's what we're learning now, especially this past year with two girls being at the same school.
Present over perfect was exactly a lesson that I really had to lean into and learn, because I definitely did not do things perfectly, felt that pressure, you know, early on.
Yes.
To keep up and all that. But just leaning into that as the Lord led me to just learn to be present over perfect.
I always say there's no perfect person, even apart from parenting, in all aspects of life, nobody's perfect. We all try our best. We try to show up when we can, especially when you have work, you have other stuff. And like you said, you have other kids, 2, 3, 4, even if it's just one other kid, you have to deal with the other kid feeling, oh, is this one getting more time or more attention, and try to split things between them. So we just try to, you know, show up for them, try to teach them everybody's loved, you know, equally. And I'm teaching my kids now the difference between equality and equity. Equity, right? I think it's just two words. Like, everybody gets what they need at the time they need it. Because, you know, sometimes my son says, oh, it's not fair, my sister gets this. I'm like, well, this is what she needs at this time. You don't need it anymore because you're older. When you were that age, you needed it and you got it. So, you know, just showing up for them when they need it and providing whatever they need at that particular time is what matters most. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. My older two, they're like the divas of the four. And so, you know, they are so aware when, you know, there like might be a Halloween parade. I mean, their school's always having so many activities during school time and then after on the weekend. So, you know, they'll say, well, mommy, you weren't at the Halloween parade. And I'm like, well, honey, you know, I just had a baby and you got to participate. You got to dress up. Your teacher sent videos. And they're like, well, everybody else's mommy was there. Everybody else's daddy was there. And I said, you know, I understand, but you're blessed to have several siblings and your dad has to work to provide, you know, for that costume you got to wear to your Halloween parade. Your dad had to work so we could buy that. So daddy can't always come to everything. And so we'll make sure that for your Christmas, you know, performance, we'll both be there for that. And so at their age, I mean, the logic is not always, developmentally, they're not there yet. And so they just see like, oh, their parents are, they get this, or my sister gets this, and why don't I get that? And, you know, it's just like, so like I said, it goes back to just having grace and for your children and for yourself and for your spouse, and also patience. And I tell our kids, you know, they are a rowdy bunch as well, because they're also close in age. And, you know, I say, listen, guys, it's not your fault, but we had a lot of you in a short span of time and your parents are old. We're old. So all this screaming and yelling, and we know you want to go to the park 8 times a day, but we can do once or one every, you have very old parents, and it's not your fault. So they're like, and Shola, I can only imagine for you, I'm sorry, Farah, school, like nursing school was so demanding for me. And I mean, this was when I was in my early 20s. And then I went back and got my master's right before I was married and had children. So I can, and you know, sometimes like I'm so type A, I want like straight A's, I want this, I want that. And it's so demanding, but I can't imagine like having children and going back to school in any form.
Well, it wasn't easy for me, but what I do is I carry them along at every point. So when I'm going to clinicals, like when we have different rotations, I tell them, you know what? I'm going to the children's hospital today. I'm going to be dealing with children your age, and I'll bring in tips for us to use. And then I was posted to a school at a point. It wasn't a kindergarten class, and my daughter was just in kindergarten at that time. So I come, I say, guess what? This is the song I learned today, and we sing it together. And sometimes when I have exams, I tell them, hey, mommy has this exam tomorrow. You have to give me time to study and you have to pray for me. So when I get my results and then it's an A, I show them and I'm like, hey, look, see, we did it. I don't say I do it. I did it. I say, we did it. You prayed, God answered. Mm-hmm. And you know, you gave me the time to study and we did it together. And there was a time, yeah, my son always wants me to be there for every volunteer program. And I have school. So sometimes when it's clashing with my schedule, I tell him, I'm sorry, I can't be there for this. I have to be in school. I have to be at clinicals. I have to be this. And the second one my daughter had, she just finished kindergarten. And I got home early. And she was to start like 30 minutes after I got home. And I was like, so freaking tired. But I need to show up for her. It's the first time I'll show up for her. But then I know my son was going to be jealous because he's asked me like 5 different times. I've been to previous ones in previous mm-hmm. class, but not in this particular class. So I was torn between, do I show up or do I not show up? I'm tired as well. But then I was like, okay, if I show up for her, it's going to be the first time she wasn't expecting me. I've done that for my son before when he wasn't expecting me. And then I show up in the crowd and, you know. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this for her as well. And he's actually going to see me there too. So it's showing up for both of them at the same time. So I decided to go. She was surprised. She was not expecting me. And I felt good as a parent. I teared up. So now I understand why my mom cries sometimes. And I'm like, why are you crying? That was me.
No. Let's hear from a dad's perspective.
My perspective regarding what exactly? I think I work better when I say something and kind of go off.
Like in regard to that tension of showing up for all the things and how you decide what you can be present for, how you frame
for your kids, or even
supporting your wife.
I think it's unique.
Well,
at the same time, it's not. I think I've been married for 13 years now. Yeah, 13 years in March, and I think from the beginning, our relationship has always been one that has had to do with a lot of traveling. I've spent a lot of time in Nigeria and the US and the UK, so I've traveled quite a bit. And I think it's put our relationships from the beginning when we had our children in terms of what had to be done and how they had to be taken care of and going to school in terms of a case where we always just kind of work to be there for each other no matter what. It was never a case where this is one specific thing that you have to do and I know nothing about it. If you were to ask her, I probably know more about my children's personal, like their day-to-day lives. And she tends to know a lot more about in terms of what the educational plans are. We sit down, we discuss in terms of where we want them to be, how we want them to go. And then after that, because we already know where we need to be, if there's a situation where their mother had to travel once to do a master's in South Africa, here. And while they wanted to move on, it wasn't even a discussion really in terms of, is it okay if I go and you look after the kids? So it's more a case of, no, you go take care of them. That's not even a problem for me at all. So like, I've never been in a situation where I've been overwhelmed by how do I look after them? Someone's calling, what's the name of the teacher at school? What's going on? It's more a case of I take a very personal interest in what's going on, because the lesson that I've had, that what I've actually seen, what I've known my entire life, is that ultimately there are always, I can't expect the world to really care for my kids. That's just the truth. That's my perspective. I can't expect the world to care for them. Regardless of whatever, no matter how honeyed the words, regardless of what people say, oh, we really care about your kids. And to go, in the end, people are going to have to take care of themselves. And my perspective as the father is to have to make sure that they are prepared to actually take care of each other. Not just themselves, but I have 3 kids. I have an 11-year-old, and I have a set of twins who are 6. And the main idea is that I want them to be the place that they can take care of each other. They can look to each other and support each other. They can be each other's family as we grow up and we become too old to help them, that they look after themselves. So when I hear about issues at the school or the environment that they're going into might not necessarily be a place that is reflective of my own background, I'm not necessarily worried about that, because I focus on teaching them within themselves to not to look to other people to validate them. They shouldn't necessarily look that, oh, if they're only Africans, if they're only Nigerians, if they're only Black children in a school, that there's something missing or lacking. I teach them that, no, that's from the beginning, that it doesn't matter where you are. What can you get from the environment that where you are? Have a sense of curiosity, not just that you expect people to be curious about you, but you should be curious about what's going on in their lives. I think when people see that they come into a particular place, they're kind, they're respectful, they're interested in what's going on, they want to help the teachers, they want to help the principals, they say hi to the bus drivers and everything that's going on. For the most part, they tend to have a much better time just generally interacting with them, because people tend to be kinder and nicer to others when they are nice to them. And even if they're having a bad day and they're mean to these children who've been nothing but sweet and kind to them the whole time, even in their anger, they feel bad in their anger that, I can't believe I couldn't control myself to the point that this person is nothing but nice to me and I'm treating them like dirt. So I focus less on what I can do to be there for them. Even if they have school events or whatnot, I do make a point to try to attend as much as I can. I think the only reason why I would never be able to attend an event for any of my children is if I'm literally physically not in the country. Like, if I'm 8,000 miles away, there isn't a lot I can actually do to be there. But I do my best to try to arrange my schedule and time to be there as much as possible. My wife, sometimes she feels like, well, what's the big deal? I mean, they're kind of young. They might not notice. They might not notice what's going on. I said, I'm not necessarily doing it because I want them 50 years later to remember that I was there at their first grade graduation. I just like it because it gives me a glimpse into how they're doing as people. I can see how they are engaging with their classmates, how they're engaging with their teachers. I see whether they're comfortable being in a situation where, when they're called up to be acknowledged, are they happy about that acknowledgement? It's kind of like they're only there because they're being pushed along in the line. How the school takes care of them in those moments, are they happy to have them doing things that are there? Or something that everybody has to walk in goose step. But they're walking in goose step to actually make sure that they perform the exact task, exact 5 minutes, and then go and sit down and do nothing else. If I can see those vibes, like, this is not going to be an environment that's going to take care of them. Not going to embarrass us to allow them to grow. So I was like, let's move back on that. I've never had a conversation with a principal. I've never had a conversation with a teacher where I've stepped into space and I'm afraid of what they might say. They might be upset. I've had situations where my wife has been concerned that, you know, they might feel that, oh, we're being difficult, or we're being kind of overbearing or asking questions. I have no problem with that. I have not. And I know that that's my responsibility as a father, is that when she's tired, when she's frustrated, when she feels that it's getting a little much and she can't take it, she can just tell me that, look, I'm not doing this while you go and handle this particular issue. She said, the buck stops with me. I don't have the luxury. And I tell my children this, that she said, I don't have the luxury of deciding that I don't want to deal with the problem. ultimately everyone else, and so you guys can get tired and say, oh, I'm too tired, I don't want to do my homework, I don't want to go to school, I don't want to see the teacher, that you can say that. Ultimately, at the end, somebody has to be responsible for making sure you get there. Like, you may not think it's fun that, you know, I keep you on task for these things, but I do it because I love you and I want you to be better. I want you to be stronger. I want you to be independent. I want you to be able to understand that you can achieve a lot more than you actually can do. So if someone's causing you a problem at school, tell me. I have no problem going there. I fear no one. I don't fear teachers. I don't fear principals. I don't fear security. I don't fear anyone. If anyone even remotely crosses my children with a chance to make them feel like they are less, I tell my children, no one has the right to make you feel any less than who you are. So if someone's giving them trouble, I will go and I will talk to them. I will tell them that, look, don't make me come there, because I will go and meet the student. I'll tell them that, don't do that. Go and call your father. Go and call your mother. Let them come and see me tell you this in their presence, that do not cross my children. That is, in that kind of thing isn't right, because I'm the one who have a problem with me. Don't take it out on them. So I'm not concerned about what a teacher might say, what a principal might say. If something's going on, I have to manage those issues. I have to make sure that they know, my children know that there is someone, that there are people who are actually in their corner. And knowing that it's there has helped them wherever they've gone to feel like, no, it's okay, I'm fine. My mom, my dad, they'll be there for me no matter what. So if they have a problem or issue, they can talk to me about these things. So in the modern day, in this modern day where people are concerned a lot in terms of making sure that we are responsible, like we are able to make sure our children feel heard, to feel seen, to feel taken care of by society, they're concerned about diversity and some of the things that are there. I'm aware of the challenges that people have. I'm aware that I see the fears that some people have in there. But I also know that the world is so much wider than it is, that I personally don't feel it's reasonable to expect that wherever it is that we go, you should expect an even mix of people that are there. If I want my children to get some of the best, some of the best aerospace engineering, I will do my best to find the school, to find the country that has the best aerospace engineering. And the reality is, it's not going to be a place that feels exactly like Nigeria. They're going to enter that particular space and they're going to feel like, it's just me. I'm just here by myself. It's a strange, it's a strange environment. Everyone speaks a different language. People do things, people dress differently. People, if I don't speak the way that they speak, they kind of look like weird. It's like, well, yes. As you're going to this place, it's going to be you. Don't focus on how different the place is. Focus on what you can take from there. Never forget who you are. You know where you're from. You know where your father's from. You know where your village is. You know the language you speak, and you know who I am. I will make sure that you come back and never forget where you're coming from. So wherever you go, you're simply going there as a visitor. Visit. Take in the land. See how people talk to. Learn how they speak. Learn the things that are going on in there. That doesn't change who you are. That doesn't affect you. Just be okay. Don't expect that they are going to have to change for you. The world is too big. The world is too big for that. They're not going to change for you. I want you, when you're done here, to come back. Tell me what you've learned. Show me what you picked up in that particular place. Enlighten those who are at home with what you've learned so they can take a piece of what that's actually there. And they too can get that fire in their heart that says, I think I can go there. You went there for it. Yeah, you were okay. So I too can go to that place. That's what my role says. That's what my role is. So actually make sure that they are grounded, that they remain grounded wherever they go. Not that I expect that where they're going must ground them, but no, you're just going with understanding that we are just going there to take something with us, to learn something, to share knowledge, to be good ambassadors of who we can be, and then come back. Some people don't have the luxury of that, and I understand that the reality is that they've grown up in an environment where they have to fight that. They have to fight to make sure that they remember who they are. But I think it's also important to remember that it comes down to the family. It comes down to your family, to the family, to our parents, to our brothers, to our sisters, to those who are around us, to create and to anchor and to show our children that the culture that we have is one that's worth honoring and remembering. I think for a period of time, a lot of people have chased something where they feel that our culture is inferior to somewhere else. Therefore, you have to copy another culture. And the mistake with that is that it now gave some people the idea that we should abandon who we are and try to copy something else. And then when we got there and we started copying this thing, we realized that this is not that great, actually. It actually kind of sucks. But we've done it for so long, we're kind of forgetting where we came from. So now we're afraid that we don't show where we belong, whether it's here or whether it's there. So in trying to find, if you're trying to raise diverse voices and trying to ensure that people have the capacity, it's like equity. Equality was equity, the statement. Everyone has an equal opportunity to get something, not necessarily adjusting things with an equal outcome, no matter how much or how little you put in. It still is a place where you should reward people for, you know, doing what they need to do. They put the work in, they put the effort in, they're willing to push themselves beyond the limit. There should be something that actually should be rewarded to them for that effort they put in. And those who don't want to put that effort in, you can still get something, but just you shouldn't feel upset that it's not nearly as much in terms of what it's going to be. But you can't get that if you're not trying to focus on what you want to get at the end, but rather expecting that someone else should come and tell you what the goal should actually be. And that's my perspective in terms of, you know, managing how my children see their education, how they see what they're doing and where they're going.
How about not? Can you hear me?
Alas, I cannot hear you.
Yay! Yeah! I'm being excited for the gift of hearing! I had to reset my computer, and thank you so much for all of the profound thoughts you shared, Falabi. I think the comments have been going above as well. Thank you all so much. Because I couldn't hear everything else until when Falabi was talking about the PTA and his wife and all that. So I'm just going to ask another question, and if you've answered, you just let me know, because, you know, there's no background there. Shola, I don't know if you've spoken about your own experience. So Canada is often praised for its inclusive education policies, but we know that lived experience doesn't always match policy papers. So as someone who's, you know, not just being a student of nursing, but also doing all these things while you're parenting in Canada, what has been the biggest surprise for you in navigating the Canadian school system as a parent?
So for me, something I realized quite early, as a parent in Canada was when my son started school. He started school during the pandemic. And, you know, there was back and forth. But when he got to grade one, we started hearing stuff from the teacher, like, okay, he's too emotional. He'll come home crying like four times out of five days in a week. He was the kid who was always crying on the school bus. There's the kid who was always crying in school. And then the question is, what's going on? But we realized that at that time, there were a lot of changes happening. That was when we had a sister. That was when we moved to a new community. That was when his best and only friend moved to another province. So he had problems dealing with all of that at the same time. And we didn't understand what was going on. We just noticed it was very emotional. He started feeling, okay, there's another child taking the attention at home. And blah, 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 blah. All of those things kept going on. And so we thought, okay, maybe the school was not right for him at that time. We decided, let's change schools. And we decided to, okay, take him to a Christian private school. And I asked, we had a lot of friends there. Okay, we're trying to do this, take our son to, maybe it's going to be more balanced for him to manage him, and he's not going to be described as too emotional at that time. And my friend told me, you know what, I'm pulling my kids away from that school. I'm like, okay, hold up. That's like the grand standard. Why are you taking your kids from there? And she said, you know, she talked about her own experiences, bullying, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so we decided to try another school, another Christian private school. And we contacted friends who had kids there. And they were like, they're pulling their kids from there, going to the school the other one was taking their kids away from. So I was like, oh, okay, hold up, what's going on? So we paused. And then we decided, okay, let's go to another public school. We asked around. And people were like, no, don't bother. Don't try. It's not good here. So we sat down and we were like, wait. Like Afolabi said, the system cannot fix your kids. The system cannot help you. The system cannot train your kids. So I realized that quite early that no matter where you go, private, public, Christian, non-Christian, it's going to be the same everywhere. So I told myself, okay, wait, what does my child need? And where can he actually do well? There were some schools here that has like kind of Nigerian, they wear uniform. And, you know, when we're in Nigeria, we wanted our school, our children to go to schools where they don't wear uniform. When we got to Canada, we want our kids to go to schools where they wear uniform. So it was like, you know, this particular school, they have homework, they have discipline, they have all the things we want. And then I looked at my child. My child is not someone who would thrive in a place that is extremely firm. And I said, if I take my child there, I'm going to break this boy. That's not the right place for my child. So I decided, okay, you know where you are, we're going to stay there and we're going to work things out, because there seemed to be a better community there for him, with friends, with neighbors, with stuff like that. And I realized no matter where, academically, spiritually, physically, morally, you have the responsibility to teach your child. No school will. No other parent will. Nobody will. So we decided, okay, it's good to go to school. Even when we ask, okay, you have a birthday party, what do you want to come in your school? And they end up coming with just one or two people. And I ask myself, didn't you have friends in school? And I realize the friends they have are the friends we as parents have, and they play with their kids. So what exactly are they doing in the school? When we say, okay, they're going to school for interaction, for, you know, communication, for, are they actually getting that? And I stepped up as a parent, like, okay, you know what, I will do that part for you. Whatever support you need academically, I'll get that extra support for you. Whatever you need spiritually, I will be there for you, get that support for you. So the system is there to help you, but the system, you had the foundation of your children in every aspect. So that's what I realized with the system here.
Oh, wait. Yeah, I muted myself. I've just been giving you guys a lot of panic attacks. I'm sorry. Thanks a lot, Shola, for that. And I was taking a lot of notes as you were talking, especially for reminding us what our roles are as parents. And I have learned from you, especially in how we can fill the gaps. Because I think coming from Nigeria as a parent, sorry, when I was in Nigeria as a student, it was a different experience. And it took me a while to kind of snap out of it. Like, we're not in Kansas anymore. Like, teaching here is so different, you know, back home. And I got to experience that because we had to pull Ari from school temporarily while we went to Nigeria last year to pick, to get our baby back. I was born through surrogacy. And the way they taught, the way they take care of your kids, they will hardly call you to say, hey, your child has a fever or your child is not. They deal with everything. Sometimes I'll go back and I'll be like, tell me how she's doing in school, like trying to fish out information. And they look at me like, ma'am, she's all right. I'm like, is she disturbing? Is she so active? So like, yeah, she's active, but all of them are. And she's not even the most active child we have, by the way. And, you know, I would do that many times. And after a while, I had to just snap out of it. Like, you know, just you've just been burnt out by this, you know, U.S. school system, because it's a different kind of system. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It's just different from the context we have, right? And I think for a lot of immigrant parents, we have to make sure we adjust our expectations and also fill in those gaps. Now, there are some teachers in some schools that I've heard that they really helped they were very helpful too. My friends have shared some experience with the teachers they've had, that they went above and beyond. But those teachers are not the norm. They're quite the exception. And I don't blame the teachers. You know, you go to a public school. My teachers, my daughter's classroom, one teacher to 25 kids. How? And you have a child who is very extra and colors outside of the line. Of course, that child is going to be the trouble child because they're not kind of conforming in line. But it's not the child's problem. It's a system that's already overwhelmed, right? So I feel empathy towards the teachers. But as immigrant parents, we need to try and fill in the gaps. Extra lessons, maybe. Maybe providing support for your child. Finding out what those gaps are. But also making sure that your child's confidence doesn't get eroded along the way. Man, I'm glad we caught that early in Ari, because we could just see her just, you know, the anxiety, you know, you could see just those expressions when school was mentioned. And so we had to really work hard to recenter that. I'll come back to you, Shola, but I think it's a good way to get to Dr. Dem. So, Dr. Dem, 1 in 6 children has a developmental disability, yet the average time between a parent's first concern and getting help is about 2 to 3 years. first, can you, before I start asking about just special ed and immigrant families, especially misdiagnoses and misunderstanding, can you tell us, start by telling us your role as a developmental behavioral pediatrician and what kinds of families and children do you typically work with?
Okay, so I primarily have patients that have been referred by their general doctors. Developmental behavioral pediatricians are DBP, because even me, I cannot say it's that long, right? Dev, peds, development, but the behavioral part, just remove it because it's too many words. But Dev, peds, basically, as a fellowship, so I did a fellowship after I did my general pediatrics training. In terms of, and that's about 3 years to do that, in terms of the number of fellowship trained practicing developmental fellowship trained doctors in the US, we're less than 1200 in the entire country. So, and we are concentrated on the coast. So you have lots on the West Coast, lots on the East Coast, and in the middle, there's like, you know, very scarce numbers of us, where most of us are put in, where we will find us mostly in academic centers. So like OU, where I was, Southwestern, all the universities, and the wait list is enormous because of just the number of practicing clinics. Because general pediatrics has become like, it's very, you go in for a 15 minutes appointment, it takes 15 minutes, they won't spend more than 20 minutes on you. So the general doctors are referring to us for most developmental questions. Even if it just comes up, they won't even explore, they'll just send to us. But that was what was making our wait list be 2 years long, because we're getting true basic general pediatric developmental questions. You should not send it to me if there's a speech delay. If that's all it is, if you're a pediatrician, you should be able to do the initial navigation, referral, discussion, questions, and send for speech therapy. You don't need me to tell you to send the kid for speech therapy. We have all the milestones that parents know and all that. So what we are now seeing, most of us have had to modify our referral intake to see the more, I would say, complex or second level issues. So I work at Cook Children's here in Fort Worth. So we tend to get the more complex kids. I get kids where the question is under five. The question is always rule out autism. That's the one. So rule out autism, or could it be ADHD? And then there's some behavioral issue happening. I've had 4 year olds kicked out of like six daycares, kicked out of like four preschools, those kind of questions where the kid is already not having success in the school setting, often because of behavior, right? And then mm-hmm. from above five, like more school age, then I'm getting questions that still rule out autism, still rule out ADHD, but now learning challenges, intellectual challenges, cognitive issues, just something's up and we're struggling with life. And the way I think about a developmental doctor is that my goal is to help your child function better in every aspect of their life. So our first initial appointment can be 2 hours long. It's not 15 minutes, because I'm asking about everything. We will ask about how you sleep, where you sleep, what you wear to sleep, what you eat, what school you go to, private school, size of class, all that stuff. Because we, as you say, we want the child to wake up each morning and feel like they can. That they can be successful, they have what they need, and they will win at the end of the day. Children are the most, they are cheap. Yay, high five, good job, sticker, that's it. That's it. And that boosts their confidence, that makes them happy. They're cheap. You don't have to do anything more than just give them praise where it's due and all that. So all a child wants to do is to do good and be happy. So my role as a doctor first is to understand all the possible factors that go into this family. Every family has their own culture within their family, not only ethnic culture, just culture, what they hold as priority in the school setting, what they hold as priority in terms of even daily schedules. As parents, like, is there a routine in your house? What is your routine like? Or the demands of that family. If you're a parent of six kids, just by having six kids alone in this Western culture is almost chaos. You're pulled from place to place to place. So if I'm going to sit there and just use my textbook recommendations, that cannot apply to this family. If I want you to do speech therapy three times a week, how are you going to do that? you have other kids to take care of. So my job is not only to understand, okay, this child's like challenges, strengths and weaknesses. Okay. Their challenges in the context of this family, in the context of their school, in the context of their dynamic, everything. And then help the family, pick our battles. Okay. Let's focus on this today. Let's come back in 3 months, 6 months, and then we'll see. Then we'll pick the next one. So again, I work with these kids till that they're about 20 something years old. Some of my more complex kids, we're keeping them till they're in their 20s because developmental peds does not exist in adult medicine. So when parents have been with us for like 16 years, they're like very reluctant to go. So my very like nonverbal, very low, quote unquote, low functioning, let's just use those words to make it clear to understand. We hold them as long as we possibly can because the transition is exceedingly hard. And so I'm seeing autism, ADHD, learning challenges, genetics conditions that cause developmental delays in what way. And as I said, my personal passion is school success because our kids spend most of their day in school. When they're home, they're playing and then they're asleep. So most of their active, constructive day on the school term is in this place that we are not in. So we have to understand what is happening. I try to educate patients, my parents, on how to better move in that circle, but also how to understand where the school's limits are. So Mo made a good point. Everybody made very good, valid points about different aspects. And I agree with you, and I want to add to that. So first things first is, yes, you are the foundation as a family of how this child enters the school setting and understands what is expected of them in that setting. And you also add your values. If you, whatever values you hold about educating, learning, school structure, school structure. I'll answer a question, Millie, in a second. You set that up from the beginning, right? Then you pick Shola, Mo, this banner, I cannot see. I want to make sure I get people's names correctly. So I can't really see.
Okay, no problem. Anna
is,
there we go. Thank you. I can take it down.
Shala made a point about trying to figure out what setting, you know, private school, public school, Montessori, all that stuff, right? But she had to take a step back and look at her child and look at what their abilities are, her family, what they want. And then take that decision from there. So as you said, there's reviews for everybody. Everybody has a review, an opinion on this school, this teacher, this place. You have to sit back and look at what it is you feel your first this child. If you have a more emotionally reactive child, a little bit more sensitive, like, you know, just an empath, like let's use that, right? Instead of sensitive. Then you have to understand, okay, this child may not do well. They need some firmness, but not rigidity. So this teacher, this setting, do I feel like this will work for my child? And sometimes you can only get that to about 80% of what you like. There's no place will be super perfect. You might have a great teacher this year that just got it. Oh my God. But then next year, that person is only going to be somewhat similar. So again, it's helping your children understand that they also have to learn to adapt with change, right? That they also have some growing to do. That they can, there's an expectation that I, as a parent, I will do whatever I can to put you in the right, as much of the right environment as I possibly can for you. I will teach you the tools and help you practice the tools, but you also have to learn those tools. And in your learning and using, you will start to modify. So that's what I do. I think I answered that question. I think Millie sent a question about ADHD and autism and overdiagnosis.
Yes. Let me ask that. Yeah, I can. That was going to be my next question. Thanks a lot, then, for at least letting us know what you do and the kind of families you typically support. Now, let's talk about the alphabet, right? For many parents, especially first timers or immigrants, terms like ADHD, IEP feel like foreign languages until they are thrust into them without a guidebook. Now, my question is in two phases. What are some of the early signs that a child might need closer attention? And for families just beginning this journey, what does that look like, right? And then studies show that Black and brown children are more likely to be labeled as disruptive than diagnosed appropriately. And also we know that cultural misunderstandings often widen that gap. So what are some of the early signs, and how do we avoid being, you know, mislabeled or either over or even underdiagnosed? Dem, are you there? Can you also hear me? Okay, I think Dem is frozen. Oh no.
I can chip in while she's getting, I know we've done a bit of ADHD in children in school, autism, and so I'm going to do the theory, not a practical part. I'm not an expert there. I just did a few classes on that topic. There are some signs you'll see as a parent, but as Africans, I still had this discussion with my husband recently. We often live in denial. We often live in, the way our culture is we pray everything. We don't accept until you know, it's the last thing to do, until you don't have any other option. And so a lot of African parents, as parents, you know, you see some signs. Like you call a child, that child is not responding. You have a child who's flapping hands, that those are signs. You have a child who elopes. You go somewhere, the child runs away. You have a child who's tiptoeing, not just as a toddler. You know, it goes on, and then there are whatever. Online, go to Google, go to everywhere. There are early signs you can see as a parent. And I always tell my friends when I see, of course, it's not everybody you can have that honest discussion with, again, because of our background. But when you see those things, it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing to get checked. The best you'll hear, you get a confirmation your child is fine. When my son was being told he's too emotional, we decided to get him checked just to clear things out, because I don't want to feel my child even need support, right? So we filled the form, the school filled the form, and we went to see the pediatrician, and they said, your child is perfect, nothing is wrong with him. And that cleared all my doubts. And I knew nothing was wrong with him, but okay, let's check if he's okay, right? If he needs help, I'm ready to get him help. But, you know, we see the signs. The school, when a child has been rejected in 6 daycares, that tells you something. It's not only about the system sometimes. It's, there's we've had this conversation. You get a child beating up everybody on the school bus. Is that normal? Even if the child is African, that's not normal. You need to sit that child down and, okay, find out at home. Is this child, you see parents tell you, oh, this child does this only at school, not at home. Sometimes that is true, but sometimes that is not. The parent is just living in denial. So sit down, look at the signs yourself, speak with people who are close to you. Do you know people you can really trust, your own community? Do you notice these things in my child? Bring out the signs, or let them, do you notice anything different in my child? And they'll let you know, okay, I noticed this. And it's your job as a parent to go back, sit down and look. Step out of that parental position and look closely. Okay, do I notice these things? The signs. The signs is science. It's not things that you have to go think about. It's science. They are obvious signs. So does my child exhibit these things, this behavior? Have you tried to fix? Or have you tried to speak with your child? Have you tried every other option? Is it working? Is it not working? It's not a bad thing to ask for help when you need the help. For a child, it's all for that child to get better. ADHD signs, autism signs, they're there. Ask your doctors, ask experts. They'll let you know, and they'll tell you these are the things you need to watch for. And especially when the kid is in a structural environment, ask the facility, ask the system, this. But of course, when you are asking, don't ask like someone without knowledge, because they'll put ideas in you. Do your own research. When you're asking questions, ask informed questions. If you don't know the system will take advantage of you. So know what you are asking. Know what you're asking of your doctor. Know what you're asking from the teacher. And confirm yourself. And you can take it from there.
Thank you for that. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, for that.
Add a little bit of... I think... Just to speak on what Shola said, I think this highlights a very important aspect to raising your children, and I think it's something that's truly evergreen. You have to be on the same, you and your spouse, whether it's your husband or your wife, you have to be on the same level from the beginning. Part of the reason why we have so much of an issue and so much of a stigma around medical diagnosis, analysis, the concept of face, nobody ever wants to, hey, welcome back. Nobody ever wants to have their family to be associated with having the weird kid, to be the subject of gossip for other people that are out there. So because of that, that desire to avoid that shame, to save face as it is, prevents them from even going out to talk to a doctor. If you're talking to another human being, you're discussing something that could be shameful, which is why prayer always comes in. You don't have to have an appointment to pray to God. You just pray to God in the back of the attack, in the corner, close the door, do it. No one hears or sees anything. So that is why the concept of praying problems away has such an allure in that situation. So part of it also comes when the husband and the wife don't agree in terms of what it is. A wife feels that we should go and see a doctor, but the husband is so concerned that in his family, that he's seen his brother. I think his brother is a rich person. They don't have any problems, but I'm the one they'll be discussing at the family get together that my children, his children, I don't want to hear that kind of thing. No, nothing. So because of that discord, the child suffers when the child doesn't get the help that they could need. Or even just getting analyzed, like, well, it's not really ADHD or autism. They just have a different issue entirely. Just do this particular thing and they'll be fine. It could be that, but you won't know unless you actually get that kind of thing analyzed. It's very, 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 very vital. It's something that my wife and I, I promised my wife from the beginning when I married her, like, we will always move in sync no matter what. No matter what it is. So when we face a problem, face an issue, if there's something that needs to be done, my wife knows almost instinctively that she will never get any flack of pushback from me in terms of what it is, which allows us now, okay, this is not an issue. We need to do what needs to, make sure that what our children need. What do we need to do? How do we need to do it? And then we just step on doing it. So it's more a case of even before we're able to deal with a lot of these issues, you have to make sure that, you know, it's not just about, oh, the child is the problem. It's that what are we working together? What have we decided, you and I, what have we decided that we are going to do to take care of our children? So it's not about what other people may think, what other people may say. If you're united in terms of things like that, you're concerned that, oh, if my work hears about this thing, it'll be bad. Then you know we'll come together. No, I will never discuss this with anyone. This is something that works between us. We go to see them. We go to see the doctor. Take care of it. I'm not going to share anything on Facebook, on social media about it. I'm not going to talk to my friends at work about how stressful this particular is, thing that's there. We need to be there. Because if it's a case where, you know, one side doesn't feel they can trust the other, they're not going to want to put that support behind it. And then that becomes a way to solve the problem that helps everyone. I feel like I'm taking this on by myself. You don't get access to what really helps, what really matters. And then the problem goes undiagnosed far longer than it should, until it gets to the point where it's now essentially uncontrollable, because now it's truly beyond our capacity to do anything. And now it all comes that, well, if you had said something about this years ago, we have these materials, we have these doctors, we have these specialists, we have this, you know, there's medication they could have taken, there's therapy they could have taken, at least you could have managed the issue so that it's still there, but it's not a situation where it's coming out into something.
Yeah. I will come back to you because I had a question about that couple united, creating a united front, because that's a big issue, you know, that we see a lot, especially when it comes to parenting and should we test our child versus get them on an IEP? So I'm going to come to you back to you on that. Dr. Dem, did you want me to say the questions again or you just want to go?
Tell me again. Make sure I'm...
All right, sure, right. Sure. Sorry, so I was saying that... Yeah, welcome back. So we know that, for example, IEP, ADHD, those are words that many of us didn't grow up with as Nigerians. Mm-hmm. And when that is being thrown at us, it's very, very overwhelming, right? How do we make sure that we are doing right by our kids, even though we're not very comfortable with that label, so that way they're not being not well diagnosed when they're supposed to be? And then the other part would be, like, for a lot of our kids that have a lot of energy and they're labeled as disruptive or they don't fit into those boxes, and they tend to be overdiagnosed. So it almost like those two extremes. How do we make sure that as parents, especially if you're not comfortable with that label, we're doing right by our kids and providing them with the right support, but at the same time, they're not being mislabeled or, you know, misunderstood because of just how, you know, wonderful and colorful they are?
So, okay, great question. So the first things first about, I think the fact, how do I know if what I'm seeing is a problem? Or when I'm watching this child, and should I be worried? Should I not be worried? You know how we say, oh, you shouldn't compare kids. That's true, but that's just not true. Because we have milestones. The reason we have milestones is that we compared kids and we got to some range of what we think is should be expected. So if you are seeing something and there's a niggle, like, this is different. Like, I'm looking at all these, like, the best place to look at the child is at a birthday party. When they're all there, the same age, they're all, there's so many different, so they're all different, but they're all kind of swimming in the same ocean. And if you're watching, you, all of us have been to kids' birthday parties, and all of us have watched kids, and everybody has seen that one kid or two kids, they're like, something's different there. Something is different there. It might be behavior. It might be communication. It might be how they play, what they choose to play. But you notice that there's a difference. Now, difference does not always mean bad, right? That label of disorder, which is the sticking point for, I guess, even me culturally, is that if what I'm seeing, or if my own child, if I look at this truly, and I feel like this thing, this behavior, this delay, this difference is getting in the way, like it is impairing how well they can move amongst their peers, that it is an issue. So the most obvious, I feel like I'm delayed. I'm good. Okay. The most obvious thing that parents will no doubt seek therapy for right away and all that is delayed talking. But there even is still some delay in that, because your parent, I didn't talk till I was four. I'm like, that's not normal. Like, that does not mean that's okay. But again, there's still some delay with that in, like, but if a child is not talking, we're going to see, I can see my video being glitchy as well. That's why I knew something was up. So they will do that. Okay. The next one is, then the behavior. So if we have truly disruptive behavior where the child is being kicked out of school, they're fighting a lot, there's all of that. Okay, they're going to come and talk about that, right? So then is the more subtle ones where it's like still within the realm of typical. Oh, he's three, or oh, he's a boy, or she's just vibrant. But that is not necessarily, and it's also about perception. So you might be in a classroom with a teacher, a dictator teacher, that person's entire energy is level two energy. So they want their entire class to match their energy, which is here. Well, we know that some kids are level three, level five, level 10. So just that fit, there will be an issue. Because the teacher, or even with parents, we have some parents that are mellow, chill, just lackadaisical energy. That's fine. Then God came and gave them the opposite, right? And the parent is confused because it's like, is this? So I like Dr. Like Okubanjo said, always speak, bring it up to your doctor. Now, I have been in a position where I received these kids from the pediatricians at age five, and parents are giving me the story, and they've been saying that since they were two, since they were 18 months, I knew something was different. And I went to my doctor, and they told me I should just keep watching. I don't fault the parents, because they did do their part. They did try. This kind of discussion where we are making it a little bit more public, we are having open discussions, we are willing to share our stories outside, that helps families. Because if I went to my doctor at two and a half, and they're just brushing me off, but I know that Mo has told me that she had challenges at school, then that person, and Mo has been willing to say it outside, then I can maybe go and ask Mo, hey, I know your own is different, but me, what do you advise? So having non-formal forums like this and being public about our stories help people know how to seek out services. That's one. Then I tell families that as Mo made a point, the U.S. education system overall is a little hampered by a lot of things. Like, one, we don't necessarily, I feel like as a Nigerian, a Nigerian myself, grew up in Nigeria, raised in Nigeria, there's a way that we don't have the same sense of community in the U.S. like I would say we have back home. So at home, I can be disciplined by anybody. And my parents are not, they're like, that's correct. Discipline her. If she did something wrong, yeah. So my teachers, my aunts, my neighbors, if they see me doing wrong, it is well within the community to hold me to account, right? In the U.S., I feel slightly different. And that's just where we live, right? Okay, so the teachers are also a little hindered by how they can engage our kids. And if they see that this child requires more hands-on, more, then it's like, that was not within my job. That wasn't what I was told to do. I need explicit instructions as to how far, how well I can work with this child, right? And without, to then they push it back on the parents to go and get them diagnosed. Something is wrong. Something is different. All that one. And sometimes it is fundamentally the fit issue. Either the teacher and child fit, or actually the school and their fit. Hence, Shola was talking about which school should I figure out for my child. But without first even accepting that, or looking at your child like Millicent did and say, okay, what does this child need? And are they having a good time? Children should just, they should be enjoying each day. There will be wins every day and there will be challenges every day. But at the end of the day, they feel like I had, you know, a productive day. If that is not happening on a consistent basis, then something is up. And a parent should be able to see that and say, yes, okay, is it in our home that the issue is? Is it in the school setting? And what should we do about it? If I don't know, okay, who can inform me? The doctor, my neighbor that shared the same similar story, my pastor. But it's okay not to know. But you also have to go and accept that you need to seek out an answer.
Thank you so much. That was, I mean, it got me a little teary-eyed because it just cast my mind back to my experience with our daughter and just, you know, seeing some of the changes. Now, for context, our daughter attended private daycare for the first 4 years, very small class, and the woman was great. I mean, as best as you can have a non-Nigerian taking care of a child, she was very hands-on. We never really had anything to, like, work together with Ari. She would give us feedback. So whenever we would have questions from Ari's teacher, when Ari transitioned to public school, she was one of my reference points, like, hey, her teachers are saying this and that. I mean, at home, there's a way as parents, you just kind of overcompensate for your child's, you know, deficiency, as it were. You know, you have structure at home, they have their expectations. But the moment she was thrust into public school system, my daughter changed. And then you will hear, oh, Ari is great in the morning, but in the afternoon she declines. And I'm like, so I'll talk to Ari, what is going on? Like, you know, as a Nigerian mom, you're like, please don't go embarrass your family in school. Or hurry up and sister, sit down. And then and now I noticed that every lunchbox, and as a first time, you know, mom, I had, you know, went on TikTok, Instagram. I even got some tips from Shola. Her lunchbox was like, you know, colorful, had everything in it, the things she would like. She'll come back home untouched. Why are you not eating your lunch? So I had to put two and two together. My daughter wasn't eating lunch because there was a gigantic clock in the cafeteria telling them they had 10 minutes. And so I was like, can you please watch the CCTV? I don't think this girl is eating lunch. Her teacher would line them up. They'll get into the cafeteria and then they would see her just bring her lunchbox back. So they just thought she was eating. My daughter was hiding in the bathroom, which is not like Ari. So I'm like, we need to work on the lunch. So if you're telling me she's declining after lunch, it doesn't take, you know, rocket science to she's not eating. Her nutrients are not getting there. So we had to tell Ari, it's 10 minutes here. Cause, and then I volunteered to start chaperoning during lunch, kind of observe her lunch behavior in the wild. And, you know, So switching her to a school lunch really helped her with that socialization process, getting in line, picking what she wanted to eat, and then eating the same food as her friends. And she got better with time, right? And I'd say that honestly, because for a lot of us as parents, when we hear those kind of things about our kids, it feels like a personal failure. Like we have failed them, like there's something off with my kids. When we carry on that shame, our children can feel that, okay? So I'm being honest about my experience because I'm a parent, I'm someone who gets things done, right? I'm very efficient, I'm very effective. So it wasn't very sexy hearing that my child wasn't adjusting in the wild. Because I'm like, no, she's perfect. There's nothing wrong. How dare you say that about my child? So as we can, you know, go back within those contacts and communities and bounce back and see, okay, if it's not happening at home, but it's happening in school, could it be because of the different experience? I mean, public school is wild. It's, you know, regimented. It's super regimented. Would the child be better off in a smaller setting? Do you have to put accommodations in place? And forget about the labels. It's about just finding out what is really good for your children, okay? And this is what I would like to really, really hone on. I want to ask Farah some questions, but I want to go back to Afolabi. You raised a critical point about being united as parents. And I know parenting styles can... Nothing really tests a marriage than parenting styles. You think you love your husband until you realize that, oh my goodness, we don't agree on this particular thing. And how do we come in such a way that we're united and we don't, the kids don't see the cracks in it? How did you get you and your spouse, how did you get on that united front? Because I've had scenarios of maybe a child needs an accommodation to be on an IEP, which is an individualized educational plan. And a spouse is like, nope. Don't get them tested because it's going to follow them all through. And then the school is going to label them. They're going to, you know, special ed, short buses and all of that stereotypes. How do you work together as a united front to you know, support your children? How did you and your wife get together on track? Because this happens a lot in our communities where parents can't just, you know, seem to get it together. And maybe if Farah can also add to that after Afolabi, that would be great.
It goes back to what I said. What I said generally, it's just, it really comes down to you, parents, like, they have to be united to understand that at the end of it, it's about the children, but the children's life. I think it's a case where shame and people allowing external factors to determine what goes on within the family. The reason why it works for me, the reason why I think it works for us in that situation that is there, is okay, so by default, I've seen enough growing up that I made certain choices to ensure that I would always ensure that my children are always going to be, always going to be central to what needs to be done. Mainly because I don't want to have my children living in my house all my life. At some point in time, I want them to go out, go on, build their own lives, get their own families and do their own stuff so that my wife and I can have peace. At some point in time. So while they're here, they're the main thing to take care of. We take care of them now so that they can take care of us later, but also so that we don't have to take care of them later, so that we have the time to enjoy to ourselves. There's a lot of stuff that gives people the idea that parenting has to be like an equal thing, and in all things, in all aspects of parenting a child, that it must be 50-50, otherwise it's unfair, and then the spouse doesn't get it. That if my husband isn't doing exactly what I'm doing to the exact amount, you measure it down to that particular point in time, that he doesn't care, just dumping everything on me as the mother, and it's not doing this. And the father may feel that, you know what, if I'm doing all this crime, we have to divide all the tasks equally, so I do all this stuff. And if she's not doing a particular thing that's actually there, then she's failing them, and that's a problem. The reality is, the way the world is today is not the way the world was when our parents raised us. There is so much more that we have to balance as people, as individuals, as a couple, as a family, as a society. You don't have access to the same resources. We don't live in the same like neighborhood style setups where within that particular environment, if we had something to take care of, we could ask our grandmothers, our aunts, our nieces, our nephews to look after school, they would go out and everyone could play as a family in the family courtyard and do some other things. Many times, often that we're changing locations, we're changing addresses every day, but moving to new communities and doing lots of other things that are there. So even if you had a plan today that worked in terms of how you want to raise our children, that plan will change. couple of years down the line, when we have to move somewhere else for the sake of the family, get a job that takes you to a different country, then the entire setup you have is completely different. Right now, say right now, my family and I, we just relocated to the US like a year and about, we've been about a year now. It's completely different. A lot of the resources, a lot of the people that we've been able to rely on to help us in raising our children, we don't have access to those things. Now it's literally just she and I and them. So we're building new connections, we're building new relationships, but it's not the same. There's some things we can't talk about that are understood the same way. We have to adjust, which means that in terms of what we are doing, the roles that we have actually change. And it's more a case of what can we do as a couple together to allow us to keep our children going. If it's a case where, you know, you want to put a child, it looks like after doing what we need to do, go and talk to some good professional, they look at the child and say, the child needs to go on IEP. It's just a matter of, if they need to do an IEP and you've really done the research, you know, you've done it, you've looked at it independently, you've spoken to the professional, got a second opinion, and it really is just like, this is not just somebody just saying IEP because they want to get their numbers up or something like that. It's a legitimate situation. And then the truth is, that's what needs to be done. Oh my goodness, what did I say about our child? I mean, our child's no. It doesn't mean your child is labeled as anything. What it literally means is that if you want your child to have a significantly better chance at leading a productive life, these are some critical things you need to get into this place. But it will mark them for the rest of their life. It's not as going on. No, it will not. Because if you're an adult, all of us here are grown adults. All of us here have established careers. We've done things, we've gone places. And I can bet that out of all of us, out of everyone that's here, I know that in terms of what you thought your life was going to be when you first started in school is not how your life is right now. Where you are in the study, the field that you're studying in, what you're doing and the roles that are there, is not a one-to-one exact path of what it was. There is stuff that you thought when you were much younger, mistakes that you made that you thought, this is going to permanently change your life forever. And it's like, this, I will just be living in fear, and it has not come up. The truth is, the fear that we have today, that, oh my goodness, the shame, or the quote-unquote, the shame or the fear of these things that are there, it feels intense living in the moment. But if we do our jobs right as parents, and we do our best to get our children to grow as much as they do and move on, no one's really going to care. No one's really going to care. And that's just the thing that's there. It's like, it feels hard now because sometimes you can't help but feel like it's a personal failing as you as a parent, that my child has issue means that we did something. That, oh, maybe if I, you know, maybe if I partied less, or maybe if I didn't, you know, drink that one, you know, the one Bailey's Irish cream that one day, something might not happen. Try to create all kinds of, you know, ridiculous ideas to try to take that responsibility on yourself. And because it will come out that way. No, it's not. The truth is, it's not within our power to determine how these things go. It is within our power to make sure that we can provide the best, to give the best, and to not let the outside world determine or make us feel bad because of the hand that we've been dealt. The world will only know about the hand we've been dealt if we are going around complaining about what we have to other people. I don't complain about the challenges that I face. I don't complain to other people, and I don't encourage my wife to complain to other people when she has a frustration or whatnot. If she wants to complain about something, she complains to me. I have no problem sitting down and listening to her and let her vent. And no, I will never blame her that this is what's going on. I think it sucks. But then, it'll be better. Things will get better. As long as we are together, as long as we're moving on this stuff, we'll go forward. It's not about going off, oh, this is just a difficult thing. I don't know why this happened to me. Complaining about why it happened to you will not change the fact that it has happened. The only thing we can do as couples, as couples for our children, is not to make them feel bad. Which is why, in terms of the comparing thing that Dr. Kudem said, I think that was interesting because the truth is, comparisons exist. I've always taken that statement to believe that you shouldn't tell your children or make your children feel like they're inferior by directly and comparing everything that they do to somebody else. This person does everything better. why can't you just be like this particular person? That's terrible. Because in that situation, then you're telling the child that, you know, they, who they are as a person is lacking and inferior, and they should alter who they are to be like somebody else without understanding that the other person you're comparing to, you don't know what they have given up to actually be very good at what they're doing. You don't get something out of giving up something. The people who are those who always be a child in the class that is smarter than you, that's smarter than yours. No matter how smart they are, that's someone who seems to get these things. But you have no idea what they're going on, what they're doing at home, what they struggle, what their parents struggle with. It's just that their parents, as a united front, say, we will never let anybody else know what's going on or ever let anyone think that our child has a problem. We will deal with this and we'll work on this ourselves, get them the training that they need to do, get them the assistance that they need to get, and just let them be the best that they do.
Thank you. And before I segue to Farah, I think we can be very honest about how overwhelming diagnosis or support might look like. But it's okay to feel that way. But when we carry shame about it, it can color how we see and also how we treat our kids. And I had to work on my own journey with that. Now, it's true that some challenges will fade with age, maybe will change with environment, but others can become more pronounced. But that's the power of early intervention, right? It gives your child a fighting chance in a world that may not always be kind to that kind of difference. So please, parents, seek that help. It doesn't hurt to just have them assessed by a trusted provider. What is going on? We're hearing these reports. We don't think it's, you know, our child, but can you help us, you know, and how can we support them? And if you're not hearing the right things, find another provider. But if you're hearing the same thing over and over again and you're still struggling with it, maybe you need to sit down with yourself and ask, why am I, you know, carrying this, you know, resistance in me? Because your children need the help if there's something to be helped with. Now, Farah, you are Gigi, and you held my hand literally too many of these moments. I mean, you've seen the tears roll down my eyes as I walk down, you know, walk away from the school, and you've helped me utter some words that, you know, I couldn't share during the meetings because, you know, the overwhelming nature of it. Now, with six children, I imagine you didn't get used to a one-size-fits-all approach, right? And each child probably came with their own rhythm, struggles, and strengths, and you had to balance it all. Now, how did you approach parenting your children as individuals, especially when one struggled more than the others? And when did you decide to step in, and when did you let them learn on their own? And what can we learn from all of that?
Not an easy question at all. Because growing up in our home, when you have six kids, you know, it's already been kind of stated or alluded to earlier. There's a lot of dynamics. It's like a perpetual slumber party. And there's always activity. There's always something going on. There's the difference in the personalities. And then it's the work on Tony and I's part to not try to pigeonhole each kid into me. It would be easy. That would be nice. You know, like we have our standards of guidelines and the framework that we function as a family. But then even the communication with one child has to differ than the other child because of their different personalities. And I'll say this from all the conversation, I so value and appreciate all the things that are being shared, because the thing that keeps stirring up inside of me, I grew up, I'm sure that I'm older than everyone else here on this panel, and the framework of school and community looks very different than it does today. And we did live more in that community framework, and there was a lot more trust of parents with the school systems then than what there is now. Just things looked very different. And even in the classroom, as some of the stories are being told, I flash back to in the first grade, and I always did well in school. I excelled, and there was like three or four of us. We would get our homework finished earlier than everyone else. And so the teacher would partner us alongside other kids in the classroom, and we would work side by side and help them along, like peer to peer. And there was a lot less pressure on the teachers, a lot less paperwork. and there was a lot less focus on the standardized testing, you know, and teaching to this test, which puts a lot of pressure on teachers, puts a lot of pressure on kids, and then that funnels back, you know, into the home. And so I think about that and how it changed when my kids were growing up, and even some of the parent-teacher conferences that I would have, and not necessarily that it would be about challenges that my kids were having, but it would be about some of the disciplines that were happening in regard to the whole classroom, and these teachers were overwhelmed. And it's already been stated, you know, like the ratio of teacher to kids. And I think that it's even gotten more challenging in a classroom for these teachers. And I have multiple friends that are teachers, and they see much of the framework and the dynamics that has already, you know, been shared of what they're navigating and dealing with and what some of those responses were. And so we really had to lean and trust on the Holy Spirit in regard to discerning and even listening, being very attentive to hear like the scope of what's happening. Because I can tend to be, based on the framework that I grew up in, if there was something going on and the kids are like, I got in trouble at school, I'm like, okay, what did you do? You know, I'll be the first one, you know, like I'm going to stand with the teacher first. And yet this is my kid and I want to have all the facts. And so, you know, like here, learning to really listen and slow down. We can live in such a rushed world and wanting our kids to measure up, wanting, you know, things to hit at a certain level and them hit markers, and just that pressure to perform. And we also want control. As much control. And I was even thinking about a book that I read more recently called The Cost of Control. And I've recommended that book to a lot of parents because it is, you know, part of our that framework and that internal struggle. There is this separation worldview, which is counterculture to what God wants us to have, that connected. And so we're all like fight for ourselves, defend, protect, and we can be live life so guarded, which puts us one against the other, the kids, you know, and the teachers against one another, administrators against one another. And really the work is us coming together as a community and sitting down and hearing one another and seeking to understand. It is not a perfect system. It wasn't a perfect system when I was in school. And while I feel like it was a better system, you know, in many frameworks, yet there are many things where there's been advancement. And we all have to be willing to sit down and work together and not against each other. But often what I see is there's this pressure. There's so much pressure from the top side coming down. And I don't want to get into a whole, everybody can have their own views in regard to that. So I don't want to get into that side of it. But I just feel like we've put so much pressure on each other for things to be a certain way. And if it was a different leader, this leader would do this, and a different leader, this leader would do that. And so what was said earlier is like, we have to show up for our kids and be their biggest advocate and listen and hear and learn and not try to pigeonhole kids, everybody into the same framework. I remember conversations that we had, Mo, in regard to Ari, and I'm like, she's not as it's just like my youngest, my son, like they're not that standardized, stick them in a chair and sit all day. They need that movement, and he needed in order to learn. He was a very social learner, so he was always getting trouble for talking, you know, in classroom. But that was the way that he learned, was in this social environment. And yet we want to pigeonhole kids. You come in, you sit down, you be quiet, you work on your stuff, you get it done, and then we'll move to the next thing, and we'll move to the next thing, and we'll move to the next thing. And even in my work, I need a mind break, and I need to get up and move around. I need to get up and move my body. Well, when I was in school, we would have a 10 to 15 minute break in the morning. We had 30 minutes to eat our lunch, you know, and my kids in school, they had 10 minutes, you know, and then we had recess that automatically followed. So if you ate really quickly, you got to go out and have recess, and you came back in, and then you had another recess in the afternoon. And a lot of the schools, they've taken away much of the outside play, much of the recess, much of the things that is helpful and beneficial for kids. They need to move their bodies, and it helps, you know. And I hear this not just from kids and from parents, but even from friends that are teachers, yeah. You know. And so I just had to give them ways and tools that they could be honoring of what was going on in the classroom and honoring, you know, other teachers. And, but that also would help them to succeed and thrive individually.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I don't know if that fully answers your question.
Oh, no, I did. And a lot more. I did a lot
so,
more.
So much stirring inside of me.
I did a lot more. Real quick, as we're running off, I had some questions in the chat. So I'm going to ask that to you, Farah, and then Dr. Dem had a question. And FYI, I don't think we can give medical advice, but I'm sure she'll try her best to, like, you know, answer it. So for Farah, Motura wants to know, and thanks, by the way, Motura, I see you in the chat, and thank you for all of your engagement. She's like, wow, six kids. How did you navigate personal life, example, work-life productivity versus parenting?
Okay. Well, we definitely worked together as a team. My husband and I, like, it was shared responsibility, shared loads. I didn't live with the pressure. I didn't grow up with my parents being at everything. And so I just naturally didn't feel that pressure. I was present for my kids, but I didn't feel that pressure that I had to show up at all the little things and events. And we made sure we our kids were active. We were active in the community, in our church, but we definitely brought community around us. We built relationships. So when my kids were in dance, when they were baseball, tennis, track, all the different activities that they were involved in, we built a community around us and shared, because we did have so many kids and we couldn't, you know, even with the two of us trying to go to as much as possible, there wasn't enough of us. And so we had aunts, and not necessarily that was actually biological family connected to us, but we just grew community, and aunts and uncles and bonus grandparents, because we didn't, when we moved here to Oklahoma City, all of our family was in Eastern Oklahoma and in Arkansas, and we didn't have them around us. And so we knew very quickly we have to build a community to help us to show up and cheer our kids on when we can't be present there.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of a give and take, and there was, you know, even moments where I would sit and I would feel an internal struggle and that tension, you know, am I doing enough? Do my kids know for sure, you know, that I support them, I champion them, I love them, even though I can't be all the things? And I would always have to remind myself that that can be a cultural pressure, yeah, that is put on. It's not a reality, and encouraging them, you always, knowing who you are, that's what was stated earlier, like being confident in who you are, and you always have people that are there for you and that are there with you, even when mom and dad can't be present. And that's the reality. Like we're training our kids to grow them up. We want them to fly. You know, we want them to go and do their own things. And if everything, even along the way growing up, is about them doing well based on whether mom and dad are in the room or present,
with them, then that can create a challenge and a hardship for them.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And to be clear, Farah, you were not a stay-at-home mom, were you?
I was not
a stay-at-home mom. Yeah, yeah.
And I never, the reality is, I never desired to be a stay-at-home mom. Yeah. I, you know, I had plenty of friends, you know, that did, but it was not something that... Yeah. Yeah.
One of the questions came in like that. Motura, you had a question about parenting style. Afolabi already answered that, so I recommend you do a replay. Now for them, how can one manage ADHD without medications?
Well, my philosophy is pills don't teach skills. Okay? That's what I said. Pills do not teach skills. So, ADHD as a... when it gets to that point of being impairing to some degree, is that there's a skill deficit that this kid has, right? The main thing with ADHD, because the name, I don't like it because it makes us think that it's just about being hyper or being inattentive. ADHD is what we call executive function issue, meaning that I don't plan well. I don't know how to use all my energy, my attention, my thinking, my reasoning. I'm just kind of like, disorganized with that, right? And for the most part, that comes with time. Even a person that does not have ADHD, that executive function is like the last quote-unquote milestone that fully matures. Executive function does not mature till you're in your 20s. How do I figure out today, before I came, jumped on this Zoom, I went to the grocery store and I was like, oh my God, damn, you have 45 minutes. And that's, I have ADHD undiagnosed in Nigeria until I came to America and realized, that's how they kept telling me she could do better. She talks too much. But I went through med school undiagnosed and unmedicated. I feel like I could have been Einstein if I got on my meds early, but no, that's just me personally.
We are shaking Dr. Dem.
But anyway, So meds are not the only answer. When I have parents come to me, and of course my lens is a little bit more particular because I see quite significant cases of everything. So I tell parents that ADHD medication is like the glasses that I'm wearing. I've just taken off my glasses now and I cannot see anything. Okay, I can see that there's things on my TV, but everybody's face is gone, right? I can't read any text that on my screen right now. So if I can work hard without my prescription, I can squint, come closer, put lots of effort in. You can get by that way, right? But that's a lot more work that you are now expending. You're not efficiently using your energy and your skills to access, to engage, right? I put on these glasses and now I am better able to work. But if the glasses are Mo's prescription, might not be appropriate for me. If it's my sister who is legally blind almost, definitely not appropriate for me, right? If I wear her glasses, I'm going to have a headache. I still cannot see, and you haven't made my life better. So the prescription has to, whatever your meds you're giving, has to truly be what is effective for this child. But okay, now I can see better or quote unquote engage better, but what you are giving me also has to be within my capacity. As an ADHDer in my 40s, right? I don't like too much text. I'm like, quick, what are you trying to say? Bullet points, summarize. So if an ADHD kid sees by the time they hit third grade, where the word complexity changes a lot. Kindergarten to second, we're learning to read, learning to count, learning our numbers. Third grade and up, we're now using those skills to understand, to apply, to be. So there's a lot more... there's more moving pieces, more balls to juggle. It's not just can I, it's how well can I and how can I apply this in a different way. So we're having to multitask in our head as we advance through the school system. So if I even get on medication, quote unquote, you still have to adjust or present or work with me in the way that I learn better, right? Farah's kid, who was the kid fun. That was yeah. more visual? Exactly. So more manipulatives, more pictures, more images, more dynamics, get up and move, learn as you move. Those things are necessary. The pills medication is only 20% of the lift, right? It can be helpful, But I tell parents, if you don't want to do medicine, no problem. No problem. But everything else we got to do. So you cannot come to me in 6 months and tell me that nothing has changed. Okay, so what are we doing? I have option, talk to the school, get on a five, do something. I give books, I give modules, I give video. I'm like, are you a book person? Are you a video learner? What learner are you as a parent? Because this child is seven, that they will not go and magically learn by themselves, right? We as the parents are the ones that have to keep the work, effort, practice, all that kind of stuff, right? So you have to show them these tools. And then with success with some of them, it becomes habit. But kids don't build habits just, they'll build like, you know, haphazard habits. So there is work like that. So pills can be helpful, but my top, pills do not teach skills. And this is a skill deficit. So we have to work on that.
And I totally just love all of your responses. Even as a pharmacist, I'll say pills might end up being the easiest way out. A lot of work is just from some of the skills and all of the support you need to know. Like for our daughter, I know that one thing, time blindness. If I'm in a hurry, I cannot put that pressure on her. So I have to give her like 40 minutes to get herself ready for school. So what does that mean? I have to get up early and help her like get ready. If I'm in a hurry and I put that on her, we're not going to get things done. She's not the kind of child that's going to sit down for 3 hours. We do private tutoring for her right now. 1 hour, she's max, she's done. You ask her 1+1, she's going to look at you. I don't know it. She knows it, but she's just after 1 hour, she's done. So I'm not going to say, oh no, you have to study because that's how I was taught in Nigeria. We don't have screens. And even the screen issues, my daughter has been used to using screen, you know, as a way of entertainment. But in school, they use that for teaching. So having to like bring that all round and be like, no, this is not a play tablet. This is a work tablet. That has been a struggle. Okay, this is one of my rounding off questions, and I want everyone to answer it if you're able to. This is one of the struggles I've had, and I haven't done it the right way. So we know that we want to provide context to the teachers for them to support our kids, right? So whether it is about what they might support they might need, we let it slip that Ari was fostered before she was adopted. And then during one of the many encounters we had with the school system, one of the administrators has said, oh, you know, children from foster kids, they do blah, blah, blah. Oh. I'll be real. It didn't sit right with me. And we had the opportunity to just call them up and be like, can you hear what you're saying and how this bias is coming? Rather than you making assumptions about my child, why not ask? So my question for you panelists, for the panelists will be this. How do we balance, you know, between advocating for our children and protecting their dignity, but not oversharing? Because the fears a lot of us in our community have is that those very things that we share about our kids can be used against them, you know? And in my case, I let it slip that she was fostered, and there came all of the assumption, oh, you know, maybe this baby, man, please calm down, okay? Ask rather than you assume. So how do we maintain that delicate balance without oversharing, but at the same time, providing the right information that can provide the support for our kids? With the premise that teachers want to do right. Wink, wink.
I can go first, and I'll answer that as a parent, and I'll answer that as someone in the school system as well, because I've had the opportunity to be in the school system and see how kids are labeled. So, as a parent advocating for your child, you know your child. Okay, like I'll use my son as an example again. We were opportune to change schools. We prayed about it. We knew we wanted a change. It wasn't right at that time. And we had the opportunity to move houses. And the way Canada is, you go to school based on where you live for public schools. So he changed schools. And we prayed like, okay, God, I know we need a change for this boy. I want the right teachers for him. And luckily, the school we changed is still public, but smaller population. And his teacher in grade 4 was just like an answered prayer. The teacher is firm, very firm. My son will come and say, you're being unfair. And his teacher will say, no, Fefe, I know you. I know you can be a leader. And he's been hearing you can be a leader from different places. And now the teacher saying it to him again. I know you can be a leader, right? So I'm going to push you to be a better you. I don't want you to be like the kid who gets 10 minutes out, who gets this, this, this. And the teacher walked with him to bring out the best in him at that time. He came home, his grades were perfect. He was like, and I was like, oh, this is my son. Oh, good. And that's because of the teacher he got. My daughter in kindergarten, when the teacher sends a message, she sends the message, your partner. And I loved that word. And yes, I was torn between, should I let this teacher know we're coming from a school where he's being labeled as too emotional? And I told this teacher, I was that vulnerable, but I told her with, I'm walking with my child. I'm telling you this not because I want you to break my child more. No, I'm telling you because we can walk together to give him what he needs in school. And luckily we were blessed with, like Farah said, the teacher in that school are older. They're like teachers who have been teaching for 25 years, for 30 years. So they have the patience, they have all it needs. And it was the perfect placement. We were vulnerable. We told her, like, okay, he's emotional. And he was able to use that to build him up. So there's a place of prayer. There's a place of coming with, I'm telling you this information, not because I want you to break my child, but so we can walk together for you to support my child. And that worked for us. Now I'm going to flip on the other side. I was in a school, like I said, I was in kindergarten, and it was a school with 70% of the students were indigenous children who are also labeled as, you know, because of the trauma they've gone through, because of there were a lot of behavioral issues. There was a lot of trauma. These kids had experienced a lot of trauma. They see a police officer and they run because of being scared they're going to be taken away, being scared of different things that could happen to them. So we had this particular kid in kindergarten that was, we always pray for this kid not to come to school. Because the moment he stepped in, everything is like, you know, the class is messed up. So the child was doing some things, of course, I cannot talk about, but it made me go back to the principal and like, is there a story behind this boy? Because I want to know. I want to know if he's exhibiting this behavior because of some things he's experienced, or is something we need to look more into. And luckily, I was able to hear some part of the story, which then made sense to me as an educator at that time. Like, okay, this is why this child is exhibiting this. And I was more compassionate. I related to that child, with that child, based on the experience he brought into the class. And we were able to manage him that way. So sometimes, yeah, it's good. Sometimes you have to pray. And that's my answer.
Thank you. Does anyone want to add to that before we...
Can I add to that?
Sure, yeah.
Well, of course, my philosophy is letting the school like be as informative as possible. But you also have to, as a parent, it's first of all understanding what it is about your child, right? Truly being transparent with yourself, right? So because before you're able to explain your child to somebody else, you have to truly see your child for all that they are, right? And some children need more motivating, more push. Some children need a little firmer. You have to understand that before you can even explain it to the school. Okay, that's one. Then two, it is not to inform the school as this is, it again, it's how you frame it. It's not an excuse. It's not to allow the child get away with maybe poor behavior, lack of effort, disrespect. That's not what it is. Because again, I think it's telling teachers and having them know that you align with a lot of the values that a school brings to the child. I align with structure. I align with discipline or consequence. All of those things, we are on the same page with that. Right? I want my child to be able to be in this setting with you and be successful. However, this is what I understand of my child and where he gets or she gets stuck. Right? And what I have found to be helpful at home is if you do like this or do like this. Right? And, but within the school setting, I understand that you also have different expectations. So again, it is what coming to them with that information and opening, inviting them to partner, not telling them what to do or how to do it. The other thing that you made a good point to say before you asked you asked the question more was the premise that the teacher, you have a listening ear. We know that some teachers are done. Some human beings, not even teachers, like they're not, people are not very willing to adjust. And my philosophy is that if a teacher makes an adjustment, it's not just for one child. If what I'm telling you to do in terms of slowing it down, give breaks, be more dynamic, be more engaging, if that becomes your teaching style, every single child will benefit. Even the one that is can read by themselves and open a book and sit in a corner, they will still enjoy a classroom that is a little bit more vibrant, a little bit more engaging than one that is just rote learning and recitation. So what I'm telling you is not specific to my child alone, is that this is ways that we can add to your teaching that can, that is helpful for my child for sure, because I've seen this, but I don't think any other child will reject that kind of teaching. That's one. Shala made a point about older teachers, younger teachers. Because I work so much with so many, I've been Oklahoma, I did Edmond, Broken Bow, Tulsa. In Texas, I see kids from El Paso, 8 hours away to next door. So I'm exposed to schools, private, public, charter, all that stuff. I have found no consensus as to which seems to be better. My current theory, my current feeling is that my older teachers are actually more burnt out than my younger ones. But my really, really young teachers don't quite know what they're doing either. So it's like, what do we find? Experience is what we need, but it all depends on where. So it truly is understanding the education system that you are in your country, in your city. We are in Texas. Texas is a whole different ballgame. Oklahoma and Texas are similar to each other. I guess maybe the size of Oklahoma and the homogenicity, I'll say a little bit, Oklahoma makes it not as complicated. Texas, I think complexity is the point. There's too many moving parts in Texas as a whole, and education system, I see it in that way as well. There's a point in Texas that they say independent school system, and that independent is a very Texas thing, because it means that we are independent from anybody else. We will do things the way we want to do them. It is in Texas that I came to that I saw that every school district's IEP does not look the same. Completely different. Oklahoma, I was proud to say that they all actually follow almost a very similar format. Oklahoma, Texas, it is, I can move 3 inches apart on a map and it's like a different tools, different writing, different, and they really stick on that independent school district. So I cannot, forcing a school, understanding where you are and what is applicable and what the culture of that school or that city is, to know how, where to put your effort. And rallying together. Some parents are not good at, or they're not comfortable, or they don't have the skills yet to, how do I push? How do I advocate? How do I make my voice heard? There's a mom in that school that can do that. She's been doing that for a while. Go and meet her. Partner with her. Because numbers will get you there. Right? If you feel like you are not heard, one parent, by the time you have 15 parents banging the same drum. I had a mom that went to the school board meeting that happened to be the news came that day. So she had been ringing this drum for a while. Autism child delayed, but not as bad as, you know, you would think. But they were just kind of shifting the kid back and forth. She happened to be sitting in that, she went for every school board meeting and stood up and spoke, and it was televised. And there's no way that the school district can now cover, because it is out in the public. So if me as a mom, I'm too shy to do that, I will stand behind her. I will sign a petition. The mom that is speaking says, I have with me on this paper 20 other families that have signed and said similar things, and we are seeking an audience. So now you have 21 voices or more. So that's how I say to speak about your children in the school and how to navigate that issue. I hope it helped.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, as a wrap up, I'll have you all just maybe go around and just share one more thing or concluding thoughts so we can just do an outro. I just want to say thank you so much. This has been so, so good. I've been getting a lot of DMs and commentaries. They loved all things you've shared. Even the ones that are not parents yet, they've taken a lot that they can, you know, use in their future journey, which is so wonderful to hear because this is what I'd hoped the panel was going to be. So thank you so much for giving us so much more. So as a way to just wrap it up, I'd like for you all to just go around and just maybe share some final thoughts.
Yeah, sure. Mo, thank you again for having me today. You know, as a mother of four, my oldest is five. So this panel has been so informative in so many ways. And I know, you know, as your children age, you know, your situations or circumstance also change. So my advice would just be, you know, I've had a great experience with our school system and our children, but I'm one of those mothers too that has no problem speaking out. The door of communication has always been open between the staff, the teachers, the administrators, and they always are interested in doing a check-in. And even if it was like a quarterly check-in or it wasn't time, I always had the door or the platform to open and say, hey, this has been going on at home. Are you noticing this at school or vice versa? I'm concerned about this. Has the teacher noticed this or any type of behavioral issues that have come up? It's just always like a relationship. But you also have to have the trust to have a relationship established like that. Because I know initially when my daughter started pre-K, I was concerned about autism. I knew she was quite young to put a label on her, but I also wanted the teacher to be aware that, hey, if you notice the things that I've noticed at home, let's work together and figure it out so she can be successful in school. So I would just conclude by saying that communication is always such a method of, you know, just, I'm speaking for our perspective, but it's just always worked for us with our school and the teachers there.
Thank you so much, Millie. Afolabi, do you want to go next?
I'd like to say thank you really for the opportunity to actually, not just to speak on my perspective, but actually to hear what's going on in terms of the concerns that parents have regarding their children. It's interesting. I would just repeat that just the importance of togetherness with the parents. I think it's actually a very important thing to actually allow children to move forward. It's just there's so much that's been done over the last couple of decades to really change the access that children have to resources to help to let them to grow. But really, if we don't keep ourselves united and we're not willing to actually, you know, to understand our own personal fears and shame on the issue and then understand that, process that, it'll allow us to actually prevent our children from having shame in the future. I think it's great that you've been able to assemble such a broad range of people that come together to speak, to show that on all levels and on all aspects, not just from those who are battling with the concerns themselves, but even in terms of the medical standpoint, in terms of what's actually there, some of the frustrations that they could see with families, and yet the frustration that prevents families from coming to seeking out the resources that are there. I think it's enlightening. So we see that it's not just that whatever hesitation we have, whether it's a father, as a mother, whether it's as a child themselves, whether it's a medical professional, that those frustrations and those fears and the worry about whether what we're doing actually has an effect, whether it's too late or not, is something that it's not just unique to us, but it's a shared fear that we all have. And hopefully that is just something that inspires us to continue to move forward and take those tough steps. To understand that, you know, we work with each other for the benefit of our kids, so that we can actually have a much more fulfilling, a much happier and a much more qualitative life experience.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Shola, and then I would say Farah, and then Dr. Dem.
For me, what I'm taking from here is one way or the other, we all talked about partnership. Fer talked about partnership with God and your community. You can create that community for yourself and for your children. Afolabi talked about partnership with your spouse. Partner with your spouse to work with, you know, your children, partner with, and Dr. Dem said, partner with the teachers. And Melissa said, partner with your kids. So it's a partnership thing with different people to make, to achieve an overall goal for yourself and your family.
Thank you.
I just want to say thank you. I feel so honored to be able to be a part of this conversation. I walk away taking so many things and feel like I'm a better person because I know we need each other to do life well. And so exactly what you were just saying, Shola, like we need to live and do the hard and deep work to live connected and help our kids to see that as well. Clear is kind. That's a Brené Brown quote, but I think it's so helpful. Like the more clear that we can be, but part of that is building trust as you're partnering with schools, like with your teachers, you know, because they're going to have, you know, a new teacher each year, and then they get into high school and they have multiple teachers. But clear is kind, and so empowering your kids to be able to articulate and communicate well, but even, you know, as the parents, as an advocate, the best advocate for your kid is clear is kind and building that trust. You know, I know what you're feeling and what you say, Mo, in regard to you don't want to overexpose too much, you know, you to where it can be detrimental. But I think if there's that clarity of what, like, here's the goal, here's some information, especially when you have, you know, trauma-informed situations, you know, where there has been a lot, you know, going on that can be helpful and beneficial to a teacher, but just having that discernment to know, but bringing as much clarity as possible. But I want to share a quote because I believe this. When I was a children's pastor, I kept this before me all the time. And it's a quote from an educator, Rita Pearson. It says, "Every child deserves a champion, an adult who will never give up on them, who understands the power of connection and insists they become the best they can possibly be." And they need that every phase along the way as they're growing up and becoming who God has created them to be.
Thank you so much. Last but not the least, Dr. Dem.
I said, I want to share that whatever, don't be afraid to ask the questions. Don't be like, you have a niggling thought, even a thought, a passing thought. Is this okay? Is this normal? Is this normal? Is this what I should expect? Don't be afraid to ask the question to your neighbor, to your doctor, to whoever. And if the niggling feeling still persists, then seek out an assessment. It doesn't hurt to get it assessed and be validated that it's okay or it's fine. That's one. And then we've talked about, I tell my parents that the school can only do so much. The school is working to a different agenda than you as a parent. A school is okay if your child is getting a C. A C is a pass. Right? A C is a pass. If the kid's getting a C across the board, socially, academically, all that, then they're fine. They're not going to push your child to an A. Even you as a parent feels that they're an A student. Right? So you have to, and it's not them being indifferent or uncaring. They just have a different rubric and load that they are carrying. So you also have to partner with them and know, okay, I need to put in some work in this situation if this is the goal that I want my child to achieve, right? But it is not working against each other. It is understanding that they are lifting the load from 8 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So I'm going to give them the best version of my child that I can do in my home so that then they return me a kid that they have added to. So it's added value along the way. And if you feel, and then knowing what is your right and your power to do. If the school truly is not bearing their load correctly, then use your voice. There are laws protecting you. I do not promote an adversarial relationship, but if we have to go there, we will go there. I like to fight schools if I need to, because we tried the normal diplomacy, did not work. Okay, let's try it the other way.
Yeah. I laugh because there are two instances that I've had to reach out to them. The first time she was like, no, we can't fight them now. Let's help them understand. Second time she was like, no, we're going back, guns are blazing. And they worked both times. So you know when you want to be soft and when you need to be like, no, we cannot do that to our child. Nope, you cannot call my child that. You cannot label them this way. And they go like, oh, no, you know, no. Ask questions, don't assume, okay? So working community. Whew. I just want to say thank you to each of our panelists. I mean, your stories, your wisdom, your vulnerability is the village I think many of us didn't know we needed. And to everyone listening, whether you're here live, and I see all of you, Moturayo, Otito, Fumi, just thank you so much for joining. And if I'm missing, and then Pedro as well. And for those that are on Instagram that I'm not able to see on my queue, I just want to say thank you. I want you also know that you're not alone, okay? You're not failing. You're doing the emotional labor of showing up for a child, for a family, in systems that weren't always built for us in mind. And in a system that is different from the way you grew up. And today we've claimed so many truths, you know, that accepting a diagnosis, whether it's ADHD or autism or whatever it is, maybe it doesn't have a name, a child is in between. It's not easy, especially in communities where those things aren't named or normalized. And that when we compare our children, it can be a healthy comparison for clarity, not competition. But don't ever say, oh, why can't you be like XYZ? Comparing your child socially or academically to see where those gaps are and filling those gaps, it's not you failing as a parent, okay? I also learned that naming the tension between protecting our child's dignity and advocating for their needs. And we've acknowledged what doesn't get said enough. Sometimes when we tell the truth about our kids, it may be weaponized. And it's okay to call authorities up on that. Like, hey, this is what you're doing and I don't like it. I shared that with you in confidence to help build support, but I wouldn't want using that as a way to label my child. It's okay to reclaim that power. We've also talked about what knowing our kids deeply and be very, very truthful with yourself. Is this child problematic in this space? What could be going on? How can we help bridge that gap, okay? For me, I had to recognize time blindness, you know, sensory overload or difficulty with unstructured environment. I'm making peace with that. I didn't experience that growing up. Maybe we had that growing up, but our teachers in Nigeria, they kind of made, you know, accommodations for that. But we're seeing that gaps right now in a different system. And please don't stop talking about the support your kids might need. And at the same time, I also realized the value of having my own community, my own tribe, people I can trust, people who have walked this road before me. It's why I even wanted to put this panel together, because I realized that many people don't have that. But I'm deeply grateful for those resources. So shout out to those communities. They know themselves. Blacks in Ivory, some of the panelists here. I mean, all of the panelists here, you've been part of my tribe. It's why I felt trusting enough to bring you together so that people can see just what support looks like. And I want you all listeners to take that and replicate that, okay? This show is part of that village. But let's be very clear, a podcast is no replacement for a community. We all need spaces of safety and reciprocity where your stories can be reflected, where you can pour in and draw your strength. So as you leave this episode, I want you to take a lot of things with you. Your story matters, okay? Your gut instinct is valid. Your child is not broken. They are becoming. Help them see, bring out the best in them, and work together with the teachers and the authorities to bring out the best in your child. And I also dropped a lot of resources for books. Thanks to Farah for helping us with that. I'm going to name them The Belonging Paradox by our very dear friend, Dr. Otito Iwuchukwu, that has a lot of gems for parenting, for professional and personal development. The Cost of Control by Sharon Amila. The Circle Maker, Praying Circles Around Your Children by Mark Bartison. The Last Lecture by Randy Poch, I think. Mindset by Carol Dweck, and 21 Seconds to Change Your World by Dr. Mark Rutland. All right. Thank you all so much for coming on the podcast. And until next time, please stay bold, be kind, and do the hard work, parents. You can do this, okay? We got you. And if there's any way we can support you, if you have follow-up questions for any of the panelists, you can reach out to me and I'll make sure I get it to them. I'm talktomo@mosibyl.com, or you can just Google me, Sybil, Mo Sybil. I have occupied the first 10 pages of Google. You don't have to click beyond Google. The first 2 pages of Google, I'm on there. You can find me on Instagram. I'm a DM away. I'm an email away. There's a referral form on my website where you can just connect with me and I will make sure I get back to you in as quickly as possible.
Thank you all so much. This was really rich. You know, I am so happy. I'm living here feeling, you know, like we've done a lot of good for the world. And I know that posterity would thank us for this, because the beautiful thing about podcasts, it's an evergreen mechanism. People can always go back and watch. Perhaps someone that becomes a mom in the next 5 years can go back and watch this. My hope is that a lot of these things in our school systems will get better with time and we can look back, oh, that used to happen 5 years ago. Huh. It's actually gotten better. That is the hope of this conversation. Thank you all. And I'm sorry for the connection snafu we had in the beginning. I don't know what happened, but I'm glad we squared all of that away and this ended up being very beautiful. All right. Take care, everyone. And thank you. I can keep saying thank you. Thank you so much.